You know, I just finished teaching a 3-day course on anti-Semitism. Man, this is an intense subject.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, we're back live with you. Wonderful to be live on the air this Thursday, June 18th. Michael Brown, praise God for this opportunity to be together. Number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related questions of any kind, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So many, many months ago, we planned out that I would be teaching a 3-day class at the King's University in Dallas, Texas, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of this week. And it's an intensive modular, which means that our time here in Eastern Standard, but let's say if we were down in Texas, it would be 9 in the morning until 5, so 10 to 6 my time. 9 to 5, 3 straight days, with a lunch break, a couple short breaks along the way. So very intensive class on contemporary anti-Semitism. Because of the virus and various issues, the class was done online. So that meant sitting in my home office and lecturing behind the computer, then interacting by way of Zoom from 10 to 6 each day. So 6 hours of teaching for 3 straight days, great interaction with the students, very intense class. But that meant I couldn't be live on radio at the same time. So we pre-recorded 3 shows for you last week. We pre-recorded my interview with Dr. Craig Keener about the gospel and racial reconciliation. Unfortunately, there was a glitch on our radio station, so many of you heard the re-airing of my interview with liberal Christian activist Shane Claiborne. So my apologies to those on radio. You heard that twice, but you can still get online and catch my Craig Keener interview at our YouTube channel, ASKDR Brown, Ask Dr. Brown. It's worth watching. And then we recorded special shows Tuesday, Wednesday, but the beginning of each show, we said, this has been pre-recorded just a few days earlier. So if something major is breaking in the news, if something major is happening in the world around us, I will not be commenting on it, which meant the disastrous Supreme Court decision of this past Monday, a momentous decision that some are saying for LGBT activism is just as big as Roe v. Wade for abortion, a shocking decision in many ways, one that attorneys close to the case have told me no one saw this coming. In other words, the ruling, the way it was going to, it was forthright, straightforward, simple, no big deal, and it went the opposite way. So I have written a couple of articles, actually 3 articles that are relevant to this already. They're either online or about to be online. But a little over 1 hour from now, friends, 4:15 Eastern Standard Time, so 1 hour and 9 minutes from now, I'm going to be coming back on the air on Facebook and YouTube, so not on your radio stations, but on Facebook and YouTube, and doing a special presentation breaking down this ruling, explaining the implications of it, and then sharing what we must do and how we must think as gospel believers. So 4:15 Eastern Standard, if you can join me, please do. Right now, phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. If it's a Jewish-related question, we'll be happy to take as many calls as we can. I want to step back, though, and say this. I did a lecture Sunday night, open to the public lecture, on, quote, Christian anti-Semitism, the rise of anti-Semitism in the church again today, and then did the 3-day series, the class for students at the King's University, mainly grad level, but undergrad students as well. So I know the material. I've written about the material. I've talked about the material. I'm familiar with the material. But sharing it in such depth with so many quotes in such a short period of time has a certain impact. There's something very jarring about it, something very shocking about it, something very unnerving, something very disturbing when you grasp the weight and the widespread nature of the lies. For example, when I would put a quote up, completely outlandish or play a video clip. Completely ridiculous. And you think, okay, that's completely fringe, or nobody listens to that. And then you see, okay, this video has hundreds of thousands of shares. Or when I expose the lies, we get blasted. If you'll visit our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, you'll see that the vast majority of our videos get overwhelming thumbs up. Well, it's natural. People like our channel. They go there, right? So let's just say my last 10 videos, probably almost all of them have 95, 98% thumbs up. And then maybe one on a more controversial subject, maybe 92% thumbs up, maybe 88% thumbs up, something like that. But if I will expose an anti-Semitic lie, if I will expose the latest anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, it suddenly shifts. People come flocking in, and now the majority will be thumbs down. What is happening? Where is this coming from? How many people out there who believe this stuff? I mean, crazy stuff. I know some of the people putting forth the misinformation, the conspiracy theories, the lies. Some are very sincere and some genuinely believe what they're saying is true. It doesn't mean they're not terribly deceived. It doesn't mean they're not terribly deceiving others. And one of the theories of Adolf Hitler with the big lie was that if you put out a lie that is so preposterous and so ridiculous, when there could have been so many easier, more natural explanations, I'm obviously paraphrasing what he said, paraphrasing the philosophy, that the more ridiculous it is, the more likely someone would believe it, because think you never would have made up something like this. You know, for example, let's say someone sent you over to my house to deliver a package with some valuable jewelry in it. And you show up an hour late, your clothes are torn, your face is cut, you don't have the package. What happened? Well, maybe you stole it and staged the whole thing. So what would be a likely excuse? I got mugged. Man, somebody else knew. Who knew what? You told somebody. Somebody knew this. Then I got beat up. Barely even got away with my own life. Look at me. I don't know who took it. I couldn't even see. I got hit in the back and then beaten. Okay, that would be a plausible explanation to cover up your lie, right? But if you said, look, I don't sound crazy. I don't sound completely crazy. This is like giant birds, condors, I don't know what you call them, came sweeping down. They grabbed it. It's crazy. Have you seen in the news? Is there anything reported? It's like, well, why make that up when you had a much more likely and believable lie? You think, no, but people don't think of that. Well, they do. And the more preposterous the lie, the more ridiculous the lie, the crazier the lie, the more extreme the lie, sometimes the more people believe it. And here's what kind of flowed together. When you see that there are just caricatures about the Jews, lies about the Jews, and they become part of common thinking. Jews are money hungry and greedy. Jews are dirty. Jews are power hungry. Jews are behind what's happening in the world and pulling the strings. Just different themes like this. Then I'll start to look at comments attacking me. And they'd be from Christians. You've departed from the way, the truth, and the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. You're a wolf in sheep's clothing. It's like, okay, because I exposed an anti-Semitic lie. Because I exposed somebody's website for promoting anti-Semitic libels. Now you're going to come after me with this junk. But then you keep reading and you find here's the dirty Jew part weaved in. Here's the money-hungry Jew part weaved in. Here's the power-hungry Jew. In other words, the libels, the lies just become part of the way of thinking and the culture. So here, look at it like this. We're fellow workers, right? You just started working. I've been at this job for a couple of years. And someone that you trust says, oh, you work with Mike Brown? Oh, yeah. He's like right at the desk next to me. Watch that guy. Here's what he's going to do. I'm telling you. Here's what he's going to do. He's going to be super friendly. He's going to be super supportive. He's going to say, I'm here to help. And the whole reason that he wants to do this is because he's going to manipulate you in such a way to make you look bad and him look good so he can get promoted to a higher position. I'm telling you, watch it. Now you got that in your head, right? And I come over the next day, hey, I'm Mike Brown, nice to meet you. You need anything, you just let me know. And you're like, he's doing it. No, I'm just being myself. Somebody lied about me. Somebody gave you a false picture about me. But now whatever I do, it plays into the, you see, there it is. And then when it plays out the opposite, then I must be covering up. You see. I mean, it's the same thing with the NAR nonsense, that there's this worldwide New Apostolic Reformation movement, and it's taking over, and it's hundreds of millions of people, and it has this false doctrine, that false doctrine. And then you talk to someone and say, you're part of NAR, and they say, what's NAR? I say, there you are. You're hiding it. You're covering it up. You see? Very clever. So how then do you dismantle this? How do you dismantle the conspiracy theories? When I was teaching about the Noahide Law hysteria and showing quotes from websites that Jews are going to soon be beheading millions of Christians and the guillotines are being shipped and all this, and I'm trying to explain to the class how someone actually comes to believe this, how a thinking person actually comes to believe this. When I go through the process and the hoops that you must jump through to come to that conclusion, even as I'm trying to explain it as best as I can, it's like no one in the world could ever believe this, but people do. We must expose the lies. And friends, part of it's a spiritual battle. You have to pray that eyes will be open. The other thing is a matter of carefully maybe taking one point in a conspiracy theory, one single point, and focusing in on that and dismantling that. In other words, if there's a chain connecting the links of your conspiracy theory, so the chain made up of these many links, if I can undo one of those links, if I can expose the error in one of those links, then perhaps the chain will fall apart and realize the error. But friends, it's scary. Yeah, Jesus is Lord, God rules, God is King. One day every knee will bow and confess that Yeshua is Lord to the glory of God the Father. I'm not scared in that. So I'm scared. I'm just saying it is scary to see what people believe. It's scary to see what's being propagated. It's scary to see what people believe about the Jews, Judaism, Israel. But we'll do our best to set the record straight, speaking the truth. Remembering 2 Corinthians 13:8, we can do nothing against the truth, only for the truth. All right, we come back. I'm going to go straight to the phones. What do you think of that? 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. In case you missed my announcement a little while ago, a little less than an hour from now, 4:15 Eastern Standard. So after the radio show, I'm going to come back on Ask Dr. Brown channel on YouTube or Ask Dr. Brown page on Facebook, AskDR Brown, and be doing a special presentation where we'll get into the Supreme Court ruling Monday, the implications of that, and a gospel answer to this disastrous ruling. Right now, we'll go to the phones. We'll start in Dallas, Texas. Gracie, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, hi. How are you, Dr. Brown?
Doing very well, thank you.
Good. Okay. I really enjoy fellowshipping with Jewish people as much as I can. I know I wasn't born a Jew, but I wish there was more unity between the Jews and the Gentiles. I believe Chuck Pierce has said, I have two-part question. Number one, Chuck Pierce has said that the root of racism is anti-Semitism, and I wanted your thoughts on that. And the second thing is, I've been a member of Gateway Church, Pastor Robert, and I signed up to your talk Sunday night, and I just got in what you were saying. I just got into the conversation, was able to listen, And you were saying something about the headings in the United States and the laws of Noah. And I wanted to get the whole context of that, and I'd like you to talk more about it.
Sure. Because
you were talking about Chinese communists were going to follow those laws, and we weren't.
Okay, so just in short, what I was saying is it's complete nonsense, complete fiction, complete myth, impossible, absolutely wrong to say that Jews are going to start beheading Christians around the world. Complete myth, complete ridiculous nonsense. And I said when I first heard about it, it's more likely that Santa Claus is going to come through your chimney on Christmas. So let me start there. The so-called seven laws of Noah go back to rabbinic tradition. So this is not directly found in the Bible. This is ancient rabbis deducing it from various biblical texts in Genesis 2 and Genesis 9. And the theory is this, that God gave the Torah to Moses for the people of Israel, 613 commandments, and then the traditions that get added to that, and that a Jew is required to obey all those laws. But a Gentile is only required to observe seven basic laws, laws prohibiting idolatry, blasphemy, theft, murder, adultery, the call to establish courts of justice, not eat meat from a living animal, so cruelty to animals prohibited, and that if Gentiles will keep these seven laws, that they will be just as righteous in God's sight as a Jew keeping the 613 commandments. So this is a belief in traditional Judaism, the seven laws of Noah. And traditional Judaism also says, and this is all in theory, that if someone was to violate one of the seven laws of Noah, that there would be a death penalty for violating that. And then the question is, well, what about Christianity? Because Christianity believes in the deity of Jesus, and Christianity believes that God is triune. Is that idolatrous? And therefore, would that be idolatrous under the seven laws of Noah? And therefore, would Christians somehow be beheaded for that in some theoretical state? Well, it's all theory. In other words, the Jews don't rule the world. The Jews don't have power over the world. And where the Jews do have national power in Israel, there's basically freedom of religion. There's not even a death penalty that's practiced otherwise. So somehow this myth started to circulate that as more and more groups endorse the seven laws of Noah, you know, the Vatican thinks they're good, different presidents have said, yes, we affirm these, that somehow the whole world will embrace the seven laws of Noah. The laws themselves are good. I agree with the laws. That the whole world will embrace these, and that somehow the whole world will then come under Jewish power, and now Christians will be considered idolaters and be beheaded. It's a complete fiction. It is nonsense. And some say, no, that's going to happen with the Antichrist. My answer is the last thing you have to worry about with the Antichrist is seven laws of Noah. And the Antichrist is going to proclaim himself God. So that violates the prohibition against idolatry. So forget about it. Ignore it. There's nothing to it. You say, well, are Christians considered idolatry in Judaism? Some say yes, others say no. The majority view among Jews worldwide today is that a Gentile Christian is not an idol worshiper, but a Messianic Jew like me, I would be considered an idol worshiper. So it's idolatry for me, but not for a Gentile. But in any case, there's been debate over that, but it's all just legal theory. That's all it is. So there, I have a whole chapter on Noahide law hysteria in a book coming out in October called Christian Antisemitism. But this conspiracy theory myth has just spread like crazy. And one of the things I was saying in my talk Sunday night was, oh, yeah, communist China is going to agree to enforce this. Or America is going to say, oh, yeah, great, let's start beheading the Christians here. Or that the Muslim world is going to agree on these laws and give Jews power. It's complete fiction, nonsense. Nothing to think twice about. The scary thing, Gracie, is that when I expose it, when I teach on these things and expose the error, I get blasted. I'm told I'm a wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm not a true follower of Jesus. I think, are you serious? Wow. As for Chuck Pierce saying that the root of racism is anti-Semitism, I personally haven't heard him say that. I don't believe that the root of all racism is anti-Semitism. There's probably a, if that's an actual quote from him, I'm sure he has some reasoning behind it that I'd like to hear. I just look at anti-Semitism as another form of racism, that when Jews are considered other or different, they're hated, ostracized, just as other groups are. So I see anti-Semitism as the world's longest hatred, the world's most irrational hatred, the world's most widespread hatred, and the world's most vicious hatred. But I don't see it as the root of all hatred. Hey, Gracie, thank you. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to John in St. Mary's, Georgia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. Hey. I first want to comment that I appreciate your show yesterday on racism and stuff. I really believe that that is a sin that the Church in America has to repent of if we want to see 2 Chronicles 7:14 come. My question is twofold. One about the sacred name and its use today among Messianics. My wife heard an Orthodox Jew tell her once years ago that, you know, we should not be speaking Yahweh. And it stuck with her, and so I'm interested in your opinion. And then my second question deals with John 17, 11, and 12, where Yeshua is saying, Father, Holy Father, keep them in your name that you have given me so that they may be one just as we are. While I was with them, I was keeping them in your name, and this is the Tree of Life version, which you have given me. And I'm wondering about the significance of that. We know the angels gave him his name, which would have come from the Father. And if that was that, that's what I'm trying to, I'm interested. So thank you very much.
Yep, sure thing, John. So as far as saying God's name, a traditional Jew will not even spell it. They will say G-D or L-R-D. Or if they're saying Elohim, which is God, they'll say Elohim. Unless it's in a prayer. If it's a prayer, they'll say Elohim. Or Adonai, Lord, they'll say Adoshem. They'll say some, which is a combination of Lord and the name. But they won't say Yahweh. They would say we don't know how to pronounce it, but certainly we don't pronounce it. And if I was doing any type of Jewish outreach, I would be sensitive to that, especially if I was doing outreach to religious Jews. I would be sensitive to that. If my congregation was in an area where we're reaching religious Jews and they're coming to our services and meetings and things like that, I would be sensitive to that, because there is a very long-standing tradition that certainly goes back to the time of Jesus and even before, that the name is too sacred to pronounce, and therefore you would substitute something, you'd say Lord instead. So I'm perfectly happy to be sensitive to that. On the other hand, as believers, if we believe that's the right pronunciation of the name, there's no reason why we shouldn't use it and can't use it. Again, it's just sensitivity and outreach. Otherwise, I'd absolutely freely use the name in worship and in teaching and in speaking without any problem. As for what Jesus is saying in John 11, I don't believe it's something secret there. Being kept in his name or the name he's given has to do with who he is, has to do with his authority. You know, you have in Proverbs, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. You have in Isaiah that the name of the Lord is coming. What does that actually mean? It's not actually speaking of the name as much as what the name conveys and who he is, the name of the Lord being a strong tower, who he is, what he does. And I look at that primarily in John 17. There could be more meaning to it, but I look at it, the significance of who he is, who the Lord is, what he does. His disciples are kept in that. That's our strength. That's our refuge. That's our place of safety. That's our place of growth. Hey, John, got a break, but thank you for the question. If you missed yesterday's broadcast, I got a lot of great feedback on social media asking my black brothers and sisters, hey, I want to shout out with you solidarity, Black Lives Matter, but I absolutely want to distance myself from the Black Lives Matter movement. What are good ways to do that? Give me your perspective. We got some great input. Shared that with you yesterday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know that Israel has used all kinds of animals as spies in the Muslim world. Were you aware of that? Oh, that's one of the conspiracy theories out there. I kid you not. I had read a few accounts about that over the years, but when I was researching for my book on Christian anti-Semitism, which comes out in October, so this is a focus book just on what's happening in the world today, so it builds on Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, but it's a complete new book, a complete separate book, and a shocker with victorious ending, but I mean shocker. So I did a little more research, and you'll be shocked by what you're hearing. I'm going to share some of it with you in a moment. 866-34-TRUTH. If you have a Jewish-related question, 866-34-TRUTH. Phone lines are wide open. Now, before I share some of this with you, if you just tuned in and you were listening to the broadcast on Monday, you might have thought, well, that sounds like, if you're listening on radio, that sounds like the same show that aired like a week before or a week or two before where you're talking to Christian liberal activist Shane Claiborne. Yeah, it was an error on our radio, and we meant to air the interview that I recorded on Friday with Professor Craig Keener about the gospel and racial reconciliation. So I strongly encourage you to check that out. It's on our website, AskDrBrown.org, or our YouTube channel, AskDrBrown, A-S-K-D-R Brown. Okay, there's actually a Wikipedia article on Israel-related conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually an article out there. Zoological conspiracy theories involving Israel are occasionally found in the media or on the internet, typically in Muslim-majority countries, alleging use of animals by Israel to attack civilians or to conduct espionage. These conspiracies are often reported as evidence of a Zionist or Israeli plot. Are you ready? Examples include the December 2010 shark attacks in Egypt. So somehow Israel got into the heads of these sharks. Hezbollah claims of capturing Israeli spying eagles, and the 2011 capture in Saudi Arabia of a griffin vulture carrying an Israeli-labeled satellite tracking device. Now, I have it on high authority that the eagle and the vulture, even under torture, did not divulge any state secrets. Yeah, I'm being a little sarcastic here. Listed under the heading birds carrying Israeli tracking devices and tags are the following. So these are theories that have circulated, especially in the Muslim world. I'm not indicting all Muslims over this, but some of the places where this great hostility to Israel. These are the alleged birds that have carried Israeli tracking devices. Griffin vulture, bee eater, vulture, kestrel, Benelli's eagle, Gamla eagle. Then listed under mammals that have done this, boars and pigs, hyenas. Yeah, Israel's using a hyena as a spy. Rats, dolphins. There's even a section on reptiles, meaning reptiles the Israelis allegedly use for spying. So February 2018, Hassan Firzabadi, a military advisor to Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, accused Western countries, including Israel, of spying on Iranian nuclear sites using lizards and chameleons, which, according to him, attract atomic waves. Quote, "We found out that their skin attracts atomic waves and that they were nuclear spies who wanted to find out where inside the Islamic Republic of Iran we have uranium mines and where we are engaged in atomic activities." Now listen, Israel has done some very creative spying over the years. Very creative. The past prime minister in Egypt, I read that Israelis ended up becoming the cleaning crew that cleaned his office and bugged the office so they would hear the actual conversations going on. I don't put it past Israel to do some very clever things. And I don't put it past America to do some very clever things. And other nations that have advanced technology to do some very clever things in spying and getting information. On the other hand, I have a bit of a hard time believing that Israel is trained rats. You say, no, that's not trained. That's the whole thing. It's like, oh, okay, got it. So Israel's going to, like, I don't know, put something on a rat and somehow get that rat into the right place at the right time to get the right information. And it's not a rat, it's a dolphin or a shark or a hyena. I think, oh, people will believe anything if it's about the evil Israelis, the evil Jews. People will believe almost anything. That's why I have a chapter in the book on drinking the anti-Semitic Kool-Aid. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to our old friend Ron in Ontario. Welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Great to be on your show again.
Good to hear your voice, man.
Tell me, Dr. Brown, has the eagle landed?
Yeah, well, I don't want to rat out. I don't want to rat things out.
Hey, I can't wait for your new book coming out.
Thanks. By the way, since of course, I remember you from your wonderful testimony of your 97-year-old mom coming to faith through the Real Kosher Jesus, after many, many months of editing and checking sources and making things proper for Israel, and it's very, very complex with a book like that, but it's soon to be printed, the translation editing process done, and soon to be printed and released in Israel. So glad to announce that publicly. Yeah, so over to you, Ron. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying I can't wait for your new book to come out.
Yes.
Sounds fantastic. And as you know, I love some of your other books, including the one you just talked about, which had such a significance in my life and, of course, my mom's. Anti-Semitism is the theme. On my spiritual journey, Dr. Brown, is going on now 17, 18 years, I do go to a church. And what I've noticed over the years, and I'm not talking about, I don't know about every church in North America, but I'm going to make a statement, and I'd like you to basically just comment on it. To me, in my studies and what I've heard in all these years from the pulpit, is that the church, not every church, but in generalizing, has mitigated, undervalued, and understated the significance of the Jewishness of Yeshua Jesus so far, so badly, and I can't help thinking that there must be a direct correlation between anti-Semitism and all the things that you've espoused today and all the things that have been espoused over the centuries with Origen and Martyr and all these guys. Could you comment on why I sense this devaluation of Jesus?
So, Ron, I think there are two sides to it. I think for some, there is anti-Semitism. There is an anti-Jewishness. And Jewish is associated with something negative, bad, anti-Christian, anti-Christ, unspiritual, whatever. And because of that, there will not be an appreciation of the Jewish roots of the faith, because that would somehow be like pulling us backward or not appreciating the newness of Christianity or whatever it is. But I think in many other cases, Ron, it's simply a matter of limited knowledge or of levels of ignorance. For example, in our day today, where Jew and Gentile worship together in congregations, and many Gentiles are part of Messianic congregations, and many Jews are part of churches, and we're united in Yeshua, that in the first century, especially in the first decades, it was complete shock. It was Jew and Gentile together. What? How could this be? And if you think of it, you have a man like Peter, who spends over 3 years side by side with Yeshua, who is with him for weeks after his resurrection, who is then dynamically filled with the Ruach, filled with the Spirit in Acts 2, 3,000 Jews believe at that moment. The next chapter, Acts 3, miracles of healing taking place, a man born lame, instantly healed. The fifth chapter, Peter's shadow is healing the sick. The ninth chapter, he raises the dead. But to go into the home of a Gentile and to share the good news, he has to go into a trance. Someone else has to be visited by angels and sent to get him. That's how big his blind spot was. So we all have blind spots in different ways, and we all kind of created Jesus who's like us. So the Jesus of the American church, you know, is a go-getter, and you can do anything, and your dreams can be fulfilled. And in most churches, most white churches in America, people would kind of picture him white. And I remember when I was in college visiting a large African-American church in Brooklyn, and I came in, and there was a mural on the wall, and Jesus and his disciples were all black. And I'm like, they're not black, they're white. And I think, are they white, or are they in between black and white? So we all unconsciously project things. And when we're just reading our normal translations, Jesus Christ, the Son of Mary, and with disciples like James and John, and it doesn't sound or feel Jewish. And then the deeper things, the Jewish rootedness that connects us back to the Hebrew Bible is often missed. The fulfillment of the biblical calendar is often missed. The aspects of Jewish background to some of the teaching. So here and there, Ron, there may be a wrong attitude behind it, or there may be something anti-Semitic that's underlying. But remember, a lot of these churches that don't fully recognize the Jewish roots of our faith or the Jewishness of Yeshua, many of them are pro-Israel. Many of them are anything but anti-Semitic in their stands, and they stand with the Jewish people in America. So I think the majority of it is based on a blind spot or ignorance, and recognizing we all have blind spots in different ways. Now, if you'll look, Ron, at European artwork, where there often was a lot of anti-Semitism in the culture, you'll see a beautiful, handsome, white, European, blue-eyed Jesus, and then the rabbis will be these ugly, hook-nosed, venomous, demonic kind of creatures. There you can clearly see the anti-Semitism. The Jew is evil, and Jesus is no longer Jewish. He's a Caucasian, blue-eyed, maybe even blonde-haired European. That you'll often see. Get online, look for Bernard Starr, S-T-A-R-R, and he's been impacted by some of the same books that you were in terms of who Yeshua is as a secular Jew, opened his eyes, and then he began to discover the anti-Semitism and how that influenced things in church thinking.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Less than a half hour from now, 4:15 Eastern Standard Time, I'll be coming back on Facebook, YouTube for a very important teaching, message, exhortation, where we'll look at the Supreme Court decision from Monday. It's not going to be a long broadcast, but it's going to be very, very important. So text a friend, encourage them to tune in 4:15 Eastern Standard Time on the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube or Facebook channel. Just looking on Facebook, Corey was wondering what's the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Often there's no difference. Often anti-Zionism is targeted anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism with a specific outlet, a concrete outlet that can be focused on. But we fully recognize that Israel as a nation can be criticized like every other nation, and that the Jewish people as a people can be criticized like every other people. We recognize that. That's not the issue. But when you demonize the state of Israel, when you delegitimize the state of Israel, when you falsely caricature the state of Israel, especially in general collectivized terms, then that's just another form of anti-Semitism. All right, let us go back to the phones, and we'll start with Michael in Fairfield, Ohio. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey there, Dr. Brown. How are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
Hey, sir. I just had a really quick question. I wanted to know about the, I believe this is a Jewish-oriented question. I wanted to know about the validity of the Peshitta. I've heard, you know, whether, you know, I've been in a certain service and whatever, I've heard certain pastors, you know, quote from it and things like that, or, you know, say that it you know, more reliable of a, you know, manuscript than, you know, some of the New Testament documents that we have. And I just, that always came off a little weird to me. And, you know, I just wanted to know what to do with that, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So it's closely enough related. And Peshitta is written in Syriac, which is a branch of Aramaic. So that's a Semitic language. So that fits for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Okay. The overwhelming scholarly consensus is that the Peshitta, which is of the whole Bible, of the Hebrew Bible and the Greek New Testament, is a translation from the Hebrew and the Greek into Syriac. Okay, that is the overwhelming scholarly consensus. So when you're dealing with the Greek New Testament, Greek first, and then Syriac is a translation of that. Just like when you're dealing with the Hebrew Old Testament, Hebrew first and the Greek, the Septuagint, is a translation of that. So that is the overwhelming scholarly consensus. Now, some feel the Peshitta still has a tremendous value because the Aramaic of the Peshitta or the Syriac of the Peshitta would not be that distant from the Aramaic that Jesus and the apostles would have spoken as a first language. They may have spoken Hebrew as well, but likely Aramaic is the first language. So, in other words, maybe even though it's going from, say, Jesus taught in Aramaic, now it's translated into Greek, now it's translated from Greek into Syriac, a branch of Aramaic. So maybe it's kind of closer again, right? It's like if I taught in English, and then you had my documents written in Spanish, that's how they were preserved, and now someone translates the Spanish into English, maybe that'll give you some insights on how I said things. So that's why it's a value as an early witness, an early translation within the first few centuries of this era. And it is important because it's in the language that's not that far from the type of Aramaic that Jesus and his apostles would have spoken. That's the overwhelming scholarly consensus. There are those who argue for Aramaic primacy. And in other words, that they say that actually the Syriac preserves a lot of the original text, and that the Syriac preserves what came first, which is then followed by the Greek, which is what we have in the New Testament. That's a tiny minority view. It's been popularized in Brian Simmons' paraphrase called The Passion, where he will often rely on the Aramaic text.
Yeah.
That's one reason that many scholars are very critical of that. Mm-hmm. It's a paraphrase, number one. But number two, because of the reliance on that, you do have people like Andrew Roth and others who are Syriac or Aramaic scholars, and they will argue for Aramaic primacy. You have George Lamza, who grew up speaking a modern dialect of Aramaic in the Middle East, and then did the Lamza translation of the Peshitta. So there's value, there is insight, but in a secondary way, not in a primary way. I reject the primacy arguments. And there's some fascinating arguments behind it. In other words, there are scholars who have their good reasons for arguing it, but the overwhelming consensus is what God preserved for us is the Greek New Testament. That's primary. Everything else is a translation of that.
Okay, yes, sir. I guess I was just wondering, for a very quick example, if you had time, from the Peshitta I had heard, and I'd even seen a video, you know, when the Lord was on the cross and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, some would say, well, in the Peshitta, that's, you know, it would have been more accurately translated, my God, for this purpose I have come, which sort of changes the context. I'm just curious on your opinion on that.
Yeah, 100% wrong. 100% wrong. Number one, the gospel writers tell us what he said. They translate. They tell us what he said. Okay? That's one thing. The other thing is this is exactly how the Targum, the Aramaic translation paraphrase of the Hebrew Bible, that's used in the synagogues in ancient times. It translates it with Shabbatani. So Azavtani in Hebrew, why have you forsaken me? Eli Eli Lama Azavtani. In the Targum, the Aramaic becomes Shabbatani, just like you have in the New Testament. So forget that. Definitely wrong on all counts. Hey, thank you. Thank you for the calls and the questions. All right, let's go to Robert in Mountain Home, Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I was initially looking at Numbers 11:6, where Jews got tired of manna, and judging myself that I'd probably been one of them. And in examining all the dietary laws, I came across Psalm 107:18, that it says, I abhorred all manner of food. And Jewish, you think of food that they weren't supposed to eat. In this case, the psalmist, there was some food he was supposed to eat, but abhorred it. And so as a result of it, I noticed in Scripture that figs, dates, pomegranates, pistachios, and almonds were prominent. And so I started eating them, thinking that was the food that I had previously abhorred. But what was the food that the psalmist abhorred, or what all were the foods that the psalmist abhorred in verse 18 there? Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, it's a generalization. In other words... It's not specifically singling out a food, which you're trying to look at and figure out what was that food, and it's more saying as they got to the point of death, they abhorred all food. They just, their souls, it's like someone really sick doesn't want to eat. That's all it's taking. It's speaking of, and whatever is provided for them they despise. But it says they approach the gates of death as I look at the verse. So I wouldn't go in that direction. It's an interesting thought, but no, I wouldn't go in that direction. All right, friends, listen, as always, as we don't get to many of the calls because of the constraints of time, I remind you that if you try to call in tomorrow, if you're able, and if you're able to get through, and I spot one of your questions here, because I'm looking at the board, they're all questions I'd love to answer, just no time to do it. By all means, if I spot you, we'll bump you up on the list, because otherwise we just take calls, first come, first serve. So let me remind you, about 15 minutes from now, we'll be back on talking about the Supreme Court decision, the implications for today, and what we should do, how we should respond. It's very big news. And because I was doing a lecture all this week for the King's University Online, 10 to 6 daily, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we pre-recorded the shows last week, which is why we started the show saying, hey, we recorded these just a couple of days ago. If there's something big happening in the world, we're not talking about it live. Let me just say this, all right, while we still have a minute or two. Let me say this. When we focus here on a Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on anti-Semitism, and we talk about the evils of it in history, this is something that's important to me as a Jew. And because of Christian anti-Semitism, many Jews have been driven away from Jesus. Therefore, this should be important to all lovers of Jesus. And then ultimately, the attack on Israel is an attack on the purposes of God. This is not the only issue in the society, in the world. I don't claim that it is. But it's something that we need to focus on, because there is a recognition of the sin of racism in American history more deeply, many times than we've recognized it, and issues that have to be dealt with to this day. And to the extent people awaken to righteousness, not to some mob mentality, but awaken to righteousness, praise God, good, great, wonderful. Let it be. Let it be. But let us not forget the very real evil of anti-Semitism. Let us not, with outrage over racism in general, forget this hatred, which, as I said, is the world's longest hatred, is the world's most widespread hatred, is the world's most irrational hatred, and is the world's most vicious hatred. Let's not forget that. Let us, as lovers of light and truth, expose this and stand with Jewish people worldwide, whether they believe in Yeshua or not, and say we stand against Jew hatred because we are followers of Jesus. All right, friends, talk to you again in 15 minutes on the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube or Facebook page. Change the world.